Occasionally, a real person mistakes me for another real person, and I'm forced to play that part to the best of my ability. Otherwise, I half exist my way through whole days and weeks. You are listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gibb Strange. The train's silence is soon interrupted by an electronic tone, followed by a soothing female robot voice that says, "Sixth and Market. Thank you for riding Trans Metro." "Thank you," I say under my breath. "That's probably the most interaction I'll have with a woman all day." The brakes of passing city blocks point sharply down dirty alleys to hidden spaces. At the next intersection, a corner street performer plays a repetitive keyboard pattern over a loop of generic beats. I recognize this pear-shaped middle-aged man as a fellow tenant. The feature that gives him away is his belly-length beard, which is half black and half white right down the middle. He begins chanting just as a new passenger sits down several rows ahead of me. The rider is wearing a mask, but it's on backwards. The plain white face on the back of his head seems to be staring right at me. At the next stop, a neatly dressed businessman sits down between us, mercifully blocking the white mask's view of my soul. The ride is quiet for some blocks until I hear the businessman, under his breath, angrily insist, "You're mixing concepts again." He must be speaking to someone somewhere else through a wireless phone device. He is not talking to himself, as we are told crazy people do. And he is not talking to himself, as I am right now. He's certainly not talking to you. Is he? Lately, I've been thinking about the mysterious phenomenon of déjà vu. I wonder why the mind sometimes mistakes the present for the past. It's been happening to me a lot lately. Is it just some kind of neurological glitch? The brain partially perceiving events, working on memories in progress, and tricking itself into a false sense of familiarity? Or could memory somehow exist before sensory input? Could everything be memory, sitting on some kind of cosmic hard drive, to be replayed and re-forgotten, over and over? Sometimes I imagine that I have lived this life before, and that I will live it again. I fantasize that if I focus hard enough, I will find a way to reach out to myself, that some trace of memory will survive my death, and during my next trip on the merry-go-round, I'll be able to recognize the warning signs I've left myself. Maybe I will be able to avoid my mistakes and make better decisions next time. I also imagine that I tried to do just that on my last time around. I search carefully for the clues I have left for myself. One of those tiny gray jumping spiders who move as if they're in a jerky old stop-motion film is traveling, in its peculiar way, across the metal railing of the balcony. I try to observe actual leg movement, but its positions change so rapidly that no fluid motion can be detected, at least not by my human eye. In a fraction of a second, the creature has moved from the rail to the brick wall overlooking the patio below. I've read that the smaller an organism is, the slower its perception of time is. The reason it's difficult to swat a fly is because it's living in slow motion relative to human consciousness. One study measured an animal's time scale by somehow determining at what point a flickering light appears constant to the animal. I think of the flashing light of old film projectors that trick the human eye into seeing a continuous image. And if I went to the bathroom, he was right there. Rod is giving me Shadow's origin story for the 100th time. He used to follow me around the apartment. He doesn't do that anymore. Some minutes ago, Stranger and I were sitting here alone when I looked over to discover Rod looking back at me from his apartment window. His blinds were open, and for the first time I saw inside his studio, which looked empty except for an American flag on the wall behind him. He gave me a nod and a blank stare, and I knew he and Shadow would be joining us soon. I bet Rod doesn't even know my name. The spider has disappeared now. It must be nearing the end of its life, which is only about a year, which is a lifetime in spider years. I wonder about a cat's perception of time, and whether or not Stranger is living a longer life than the behemoth on the other side of the balcony. Looking down at Stranger sprawled out in a state of pure bliss, I decide to take her lead. I relax and lean back in my chair. I look up at the sky and watch the clouds roll to another retelling of Rod's life story. He explains how he never had a cat before Shadow, how his dad hated cats and dogs, hated all animals. How Rod was the youngest of 13 children. He always emphasizes the number 13. Rod keeps talking. I close my eyes. 13 children, though some died at birth, and a few more died in car crashes. His brother would have survived if he didn't try to climb out of the window as the car was rolling over. His sister tried to share a dirt road with a big truck. Should have just waited. A lifetime has passed before me, specifically Rod's lifetime. When I finally open my eyes, I find Shadow's glare still fixed on my little stranger, who, in contrast, is still basking in the warm light, not a care in her world. Rod goes back inside, leaving Stranger and I alone in silence with Shadow. The three of us stare at each other until Rod returns with another little glass of cheap beer. Smaller glasses help Rod deceive himself. I'm not supposed to, but I do, he says with a smile, before shifting to a serious tone. I don't think that much. I nod silently, thinking of all the broken glass he's left out on the balcony. But you only live once, Rod says, raising his glass as if to toast. Then, like clockwork, he adds, Far as I know. For someone who's only living once, Rod sure does repeat himself a lot. Rod returns to the idea that if he didn't have Shadow, he wouldn't be stuck here. Where would you be, Rod? I shout. California, he answers immediately, nodding his head with total certainty. You could take Shadow with you. I'd need a car for that, he says. Just then, a waft of Rod's cheap beer hits me. Some people might wonder whose cat's whose, Rod says. I find myself taking offense to this comment as I look over at Shadow resting on his giant tummy. Rod must notice a look in my eyes, because out of nowhere, he comes to Shadow's defense. My sister had a cat twice as big. Jesus. I try to imagine what that animal would look like. Can't remember its name now, Rod says as he stares into space. It had a name. A chubby, disheveled lady wearing sweatpants sits alone in the entryway of an old hotel. I wouldn't quite say she's talking to herself, but an inner dialogue does seem to be spilling into the outer world. Fortunately, it's not angry or violent. In fact, she seems almost in a state of bliss. As I walk by, she looks up at me and meows like a cat. Without thinking, I find myself meowing right back. Good kitty, she says. There is a metal clanging echoing through the city. A tiny man with a sledgehammer is pounding on the metal frame of a new building high above the city skyline. On the corner, a bag lady is shouting the name of a pawn shop into a phone, but the device misunderstands her and can't provide the necessary information. I decide to take a rest by the library and watch the man with the hammer. The soundtrack is out of sync, I think to myself. That is, the image is distant enough that there is a delay. I see the hit before I hear it. The same effect one notices during a 4th of July fireworks display. Each time the man lifts the hammer, another strike rings through the city. I wait for him to stop, even for just a moment, just to find out how far behind the sound is. Probably only one strike, or one and a half, but you wouldn't know it from the streaming confusion of appearances. The action is so relentlessly monotonous that it could even be the other way around. I could just as easily be hearing it before seeing it. Tap, 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 tap. No one knows what to do. Everyone's complained except for the deaf tenants. Night security barely patrols anymore. Rumors of budget cuts. The office staff tell me it's not even worth filing complaints anymore. Management's impotent responses lead us to speculate that any action is being hindered by corporate and legal forces beyond view. And what action should be taken? Eviction? Where would Sam go then?
Sometimes you just gotta beat the crazy out of them,
suggests Roy as he and I ride up in the elevator together for the third time this week. Roy is an older man, former military. He's only worked here for a few months, but this is not the first time he's proposed the boot camp solution. As usual, the idea of everyone banding together to physically assault Sam is met with a blank stare on my part. Another of Roy's charming but impossible to execute ideas involves moving all the crazies to the second floor so that everyone else in the building may live in peace. I tell Roy he's optimistic to suggest that only one floor would be needed. I'm tired of the same ride up in the elevator and the same conversation, and I miss sleeping. I miss dreaming, too. At this point in the conversation, Roy always turns to me and asks,
"You don't think, I mean, you know, you don't think there's any chance the guy down below is actually doing something, do you?"
Roy has spent hours standing outside both men's apartments, waiting to catch either in the act. Of course, as soon as he returns to the office, another incident occurs. I look at Roy with tired eyes.
Maybe Sam is pacing around in his room, causing static electricity to build up. Maybe he's covered his apartment in tinfoil, and it's creating a galvanic shock. Maybe we could build him a makeshift Faraday cage to shield him from electrostatic influences.
Roy looks at me, unsure if I'm being serious. He begins to speak but hesitates, his brow furrowed. Roy will be turning these new theories over in his mind all night long.
"Hey, who is the guy downstairs anyway?" I ask. "He must be going insane." "Great big guy," Roy says. "He's got a beard, half of it is white, and the other half is black." "That guy?"
"That's Dietzen." I'm suddenly awake. "The street performer. Plays xylophone down on Clark Street." This new information makes sense somehow. I wonder if the whole conflict was triggered by the man's beard. Half black, half white. I'd love to get his half of the story. Last week, when Sam used his cane to reach out and pound on Dietzen's window below, someone,
probably Dietzen, called the police. He'd struck with such force I was surprised the glass didn't break. When the police arrived, I listened at my door.
"He's like some kind of Morlock Six Society person,"
Sam explained to the officer. Unimpressed, I guess the cop must have told Sam to quiet down, because then Sam shouted,
"He's making a fool of you!"
and slammed the door. If Morlock is a reference to the underground dwellers of H.G. Wells' sci-fi classic, The Time Machine, then maybe there's some kind of class element to the story. You see, no one in this building ever thought they'd end up here. Everyone's here because they made mistakes. And Sam probably thinks he's better than the dirty old hippie with the crazy beard. I think I'm above it all, too. But I'm not. A few days ago, I finally lost the last of my precious emotional equilibrium and confronted Sam. I demanded to know if the tapping was actually helping. That is, when he pounded on the floor, did the guy stop shooting him with the ray gun? To my surprise, Sam calmly responded yes, forcing me to reevaluate the Albert Einstein quote that cognitive behavioral therapists are so fond of. The one about how doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results is the definition of insanity. Now here's a situation that challenges that notion, doesn't it? Could my neighbor be redefining insanity, and therefore sanity as well? Of course, I had to remind myself that his relief is only temporary, as a few hours later, the phasers are back, and the cycle continues. Then again, all coping mechanisms are temporary solutions. Before we part ways, Roy pitches one last idea to me.
What about just telling him that we've installed a metal shield under the floor below him? You know, the power of suggestion.
I like it. Good idea, Roy. A knock on the door wakes me up. It's Dan, the busy but always friendly maintenance man, and he's holding a blender. He explains he's been cleaning out Rod's apartment.
Why?
I ask.
Did he die?
Yeah, he says, extending the blender to me. You didn't hear? I'm having some trouble accepting the offering, so eventually Dan reaches past me and sets the appliance down on the kitchenette counter. For a long moment, the two of us stare at the blender in silence.
Blends right in, I finally admit.
You have been listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gib Strange.